I think that's most people. So, for this morning's talk, again, I try and get some connection, continuity from what was said yesterday. But I wanted to focus mostly on what we call the five hindrances. And it's something which the Buddha talked about a lot and emphasized a lot. And it is just what obstructs the mind from being able to be peaceful, and also obstructs the mind from being able to see clearly and get insight. Because understanding and insight obviously is such an important part of our path. But why is it that many really good people argue about what is right and what is wrong, what is truthful? And there must be something there which is blocking a person from seeing the truth, or seeing what's real. And of course, you know, you come across that really, really often. And one of the stories to illustrate that was this wonderful story of the levitating flower pot. And the origin of this story, for those who have not heard of it before, it was from one of my friends at university. And he was the first Buddhist I ever met in my life, this life. And the reason was that, you know, I became a Buddhist when I was 16. And the Wahawa became a Buddhist, which was going to a bookshop, because I won my first school prize. You know, you blossom late at school. It's much better to blossom late than blossom early and then lose it afterwards. So I got a prize for my A-level results. And my teacher told me, go to the bookshop and get more books on mathematics. And I didn't know what to do, so I went to the bookshop and saw these books on mathematics. And straight away I thought, no way am I going to waste my first school prize on stuff I can get from the school library. So instead, this was in this big bookshop in Tottenham Court Road in London, Foyles, and it's very old and well-established bookshop. But on the opposite side of the road, they had the annex. And in the top story of the annex, about, you know, six flights of stairs up, that was the stuff they had, all like the forbidden section. Things on modern psychology, sociology, and also religions other than Christianity. And basically, just because it was the forbidden stuff, that's what made it interesting. So because I went up there and bought a number of paperbacks. I got told off by that, buying paperbacks. But the paperbacks I got were mostly on the different religions. Because I thought, well, you know, you've got to have a spirituality in life. It made no sense to me, you know, as a rationalist. Why should you just choose the religion you're born into, rather than have the opportunity to find out what's best for you? Just like these days, just because, you know, you say you were born in Malaysia, doesn't mean you always have to eat Malaysian food. You can eat all types of food, whichever you find is most delicious. So because of that, I thought, well, let's get books on all the different types of religions I could afford, read them, and make a choice. And of course, these days, that sort of idea has a name. It's called, like, doing a market research. See what's on offer. If you're going to get a new car, you don't just get the car which you had last time. You don't get the different types of car which best suits you. So, and that was when I read my first book on Buddhism. I thought, yeah, this is really for me. Because I always believed in rebirth, reincarnation. And I always believed in, like, compassion. That really stood out in the first book I read about Buddhism. And also, it was not about believing things. It's more like, this is the, you know, what we say is the truth, but this is how to find out for yourself. And it wasn't about asking the priest and then believing what the priest said. You question and argue, and that is encouraged and respected. And so that was really inspired me, so I became a Buddhist. But what to do next? So really what I should have done, look in a phone book under B for Buddhist or something. There's no internet in those days. So, but I just left it for a while. But when I went up to university, they had this fair of all the different clubs and societies. I remember one club and society I saw there, but I thought, no, I'm not going to join that one, was the Fox Hunting Society. And this was snobby Cambridge. So you could join a society and go on a horse and chasing those poor little foxes. But the one which really made my eyes go wide was there's a Buddhist society there. And I was really exciting. And I saw there's a Buddhist society in the universe I'm going to spend the next 3 years. Yay! And I was so excited, I went up to the desk there. And of course, I had a student manning the desk, and I said, I want to join. And the student on the desk said, you don't have to join. You know, you don't have to convert to join or anything. Just come and see how you like it, all for free. I said, no, I'm already a Buddhist. I want to join. He said, no, you don't have to. No, come and see. And I got angry. The fee was £1. That's a lot of money for a poor student. But I got a pound out of my wallet, slammed on the table, join me now. And so the guy joined me. But I always remember him because that was an important event in my life. And he became a very good friend, a lifelong friend. And he also became a very lifelong friend of Professor Hawkins. He was one of his chief students. And he was featured in the biopic of Stephen Hawking's The Theory of Everything, I think it was called. And I never knew that at the time. But, you know, we're all into the same sort of things. That's why we became friends. He was obviously a Buddhist. That's why he's on the counter. And he was a physicist as well, about a year or two ahead of me. And he was also in the Psychic Research Society. Because, you know, as students, especially what people who are like physicists or Buddhists, we're really interested. We really want to find out. And, you know, you have that courage to go places which are haunted and just find out if there's anything there. And, of course, being a physicist, you know, you can get all this equipment to try and get some infrared photos of a ghost or something to see what's happening there. So he was into that as well. And also in the Astronomical Society, which I was into. So anyway, we just shared so much. Then years and years and years later, when we had one of those conferences here in the convention centre in Perth, I wanted him to come over. And it was almost an excuse to force him to come over as an old friend to see Bodhinyana Monastery, see how he lived. So he came over with his wife and he made his presentation. And it's lovely to see him. But he was a really well-known physicist, emeritus professor of theoretical physics at Queen Mary College in London. And he's actually more famous in physics than I realised. But anyway, because he also does this psychic research, he was a president and the treasurer of the Psychic Research Society in London. We try to keep that quiet because, you know, people would think that, my goodness, he's a weirdo. How can you have weirdos who believe in ghosts? You know, being close associates of Professor Stephen Hawking's. But anyway, so he told his amazing stories of all the research he'd done over those years. And because he's a good friend, he's absolutely trustworthy. And he said one of the experiments which they did in the Psychic Research Society and also in physics was the levitating flower pot experiment. I mentioned this quite a few times. Many of you know this story, but it's a very important story because they had this private demonstration in the Imperial College London. Imperial College is just a technology university, and they get amazing sort of professors there. But anyway, that they had this demonstration, not for students, only for professors, lecturers, of the levitating flower pot. One of these physicists said he found out how to levitate things. So all these crusty old professors, these lecturers, these experimenters, who were supposed to be trained in observation, they were all sitting down when the demonstrator, the person giving the lecture, came into the room holding a flower pot. And if you remember some of those old university lecture theatres, they usually have a bench in the front, and they have on the bleachers the rows going up, 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 the little desk. So that's where the professors were sitting. And so the physicist making this demonstration, he put the flower pot on the table, no wires or anything. And he said, we're now going to levitate this flower pot, make it rise up into the air. It had lots of cameras there, top of the range cameras, you know, because, you know, from the university. So if anything happens, we can video it in UV, infrared, everything. And so if it works, we have evidence. But then, the quirk of the experiment, he said, but we'll have to ask everybody to help, to create the right atmosphere. I want each one of you, to the best of your ability, to start chanting Om, the old Hindu sacred word, Om. And I wish I was there at the time, because I know these old professors. To see an old professor lecturing, going Om, 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 would have cracked me up. But they did it. They were chanting Om, 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 Om. Because it was only just their friends. That's why they didn't have any students there. So they could feel quite at ease going Om. And as they were chanting Om, the flower pot lifted up above the bench. It actually worked. And they filmed it. They photographed it. It was real. They levitated the flower pot. And then afterwards, it's only a short experiment, afterwards, the experimenter asked them, what do you think of that? And this was the main point of the experiment, the reactions of those who were watching. And some of those physicists, scientists, electrical engineers, people who spend their whole life doing experiments and observing, said that the flower pot never lifted at all. The flower pot was on the table throughout the experiment. It didn't lift. It didn't move. They showed the video. They showed the photo. Said, no, no, that's, you know, what we call these days fake news. It was doctored. It was, you know, I was watching with my eyes and it stayed on the table all the time. And that was the amazing thing. These were people trained in observation. And all they saw was a flower pot remaining on the table, when in fact it did lift up off the table. But it was such a challenge to their ideas about the world and what is possible, what is not possible. For them, it was impossible. They trained in physics and science for all their life, and that cannot happen. And because it could not happen, they didn't even see it. It didn't even come to their conscious awareness. It was blocked out before they were aware of it. That bare awareness, for most people, it's not bare awareness at all. What you're aware of has been filtered, blocked, embellished to suit you. This is where we're going to get to the five hindrances in a moment. What blocks and embellishes and exaggerates. But the truth of the matter was, as many people have heard me say this story before, that they'd installed this huge electromagnet under the bench. And whenever you turn on such a power-sucking piece of equipment, you can actually hear the electric current hum. Mm, which is why they had to chant Om to master the sound of current being turned off so they wouldn't guess what was happening. That made me laugh as it made you laugh. It's a brilliant piece of electrical tomfoolery. But anyway, the flower pot did actually lift, but the purpose of the experiment was to see if when it did lift, and people didn't know how it was done, they really thought it was some magic or psychic powers, they didn't even see it. It wasn't as if they saw it and said, no, I must be dreaming. It never even came to their primary awareness. And that's the whole point of the experiment. I remember also just This other thing was not written up, but he said he'd been with some of his friends, you know, top scientists, in London to these psychics who were just levitating tables. And he said one of his friends, now when this was happening, he was free to just have a walk around underneath the table, see if there was anything really to make it move. And he couldn't find anything to actually to cause in science a table to lift up with these psychics with their hands on it. And then he said, I must be hallucinating. They must have put something in my tea or my scones, which I ate just before this experiment. It can't be true. And this is one of the problems. If you think it can't be true, you'll block it out. You won't see it. That has a huge effect, not just on science and levitating tables, but even on your life. A story which comes to mind many years ago, so I don't mind saying it now. There was one of the people who came to our Armadale group. We have a meditation group in Armadale, in the hospital there. And she didn't come because she was a Buddhist or she really liked meditation so much. She was just in an enormous psychological turmoil. And the reason was, when you could take her aside and talk about to her, that her school, she had two kids, they were twins. And the school had discovered that they were being sexually abused by her husband. And police came round, kids were not there, husband had been arrested. Why? What's happening? And she felt this mixture of a conflict, because this was a man she wanted to spend her life with, father of her kids, and found this is what he did. She couldn't understand that. And she also, as a mother, felt so incredibly guilty that, you know, she'd been in the same house and she hadn't seen this happen. Or had she seen it happen and just denied it? But she felt so guilty that on her watch, 24/7 watch, she hadn't suspected anything. And that was actually when I told her, look, you know, this, you know, in the way the mind works, it was something which is so hard to see, so challenging. This is, you know, her life was just turned upside down. And she felt so guilty for this. And said, I can understand how you can't see this, because it's just way too challenging. And she still loved that man. You know, it's, but then that's what he did to his kids. So she blocked out any evidence, you know, which was in front of her, what was happening, because to admit it was way too challenging and painful. But of course, once the school counsellor found out, then there was nothing else she could do. She eventually just, with her two kids, moved to UK and so spent the rest of her life there, doing really, really well. But you can see just how something like that, would you be able to admit that straight away? Or would you block it out as well? It's just way too challenging. And there's many things in the life which are way too challenging. To make it a little bit more light, you got your relationships, marriage. And why is it that when people get married, oh, I love everything about you, darling. You're so cute. Even the way you pick your nose is so charming. That's an exaggeration, because I've never been married myself, obviously. But that's what it feels like. And then after a couple of years, sometimes I think, why on earth did I ever marry that guy? What did I see in her? To the point that one of these really nice disciples over in Singapore, she was a marriage counsellor for a while, and she said that when she got married, her father took her new husband aside. He had wanted to have some father-in-law, son-in-law sort of bonding. So the father-in-law told his new son-in-law, just after the marriage, he said, you know, you probably love my daughter really, really well. He said, oh, yes, she's so charming, she's so wonderful. Everything she does is just so lovable. I'm so lucky to be the one she's chosen and I can be her husband. And anyway, Then the father-in-law just rolled his eyes and said, son-in-law. That's wonderful. That's how it usually is, you know, when you get married, fall in love. But in a couple of years' time, maybe 3 years, maybe shorter, I'm not sure, but in around 2 or 3 years' time, you'll begin to see the faults and defects in my daughter. But I want you to remember something. When you start to see those faults and defects in my daughter, remember they were there from the very beginning. And if my daughter didn't have those faults and defects to begin with, she would have married someone much better than you. It's a reality check. But the point is, you don't see what's there. You see what you want to see. And you hide what is just too challenging for you to see. And that is caused by these things called the hindrances. And this is just in ordinary life, let alone just in your meditation and getting real deep insight into the nature of your body and mind. So what are those hindrances? I think many of you know that in brief. It's the first hindrance is wanting, the second is ill will, the third is sloth and torpor, the fourth is restlessness and remorse, and the fifth is doubt. These are all the stuff which twists what comes to your cognitive awareness. So you can't really trust what you see. You see what you want to see. You hide what you don't want to see. And of course, sloth and torpor, you're just too dull to really see clearly. Restlessness, you know, you just can't stay long enough anywhere to actually see clearly. On the restlessness, there's this one little anecdote, which is a very beautiful one. I usually tell it on most meditation retreats, but it is something which is so relevant. Little experiences which happen in my life, which you can remember, adjust a little bit, but let people know that this is how the restlessness works. That coming here to Australia and finding this beautiful piece of land, which is now Bodhinyana Monastery, that was 36, 37 years ago now. And so the first 6 or 7 years, I was really busy building the place up. There was no buildings on there at all when we first arrived. So we're just sleeping out under the trees. But over those years, we started to build. So a lot of the time, it was really a huge amount of work and coming and going, getting building supplies from town. But on this one occasion, I forget exactly why, but you know, I had lots of time. I arrived maybe at 9 o'clock or something. And I asked the driver, please let me off at the bottom of the Kingsby Drive. I want to walk up today. It's a beautiful spring morning. And I, you know, just love the exercise and just time just to walk and just relax. And that is 2.2 kilometers from the Southwest Highway up to the gate of Bodhinyana Monastery. It's not that far. It's steep. But this was, I think, roughly the first time I walked up that hill for the 7 years since we came to live there. And as I started walking up the hill, it was a wonderful thing I did because I couldn't recognize my surroundings. It was like I was on a different hillside. The things I saw which I'd never seen before. And it was so staggering. I thought, what's going on here? This is weird. It's totally different than what I remember seeing maybe 2 or 3 times a week through the window of a car going up 40, 50, 60 kilometers an hour. And I couldn't understand why it looked so different. But then, because I was quite surprised, I stopped and stood perfectly still and just stared. And then the hillside changed again. And when I just stood perfectly still, oh, that hillside looked so incredibly beautiful. And I saw so much more detail. I could see more. And everything was, the colours were richer, were deeper. And I just wondered, what the heck's going on? Did someone put some drugs in my tea this morning, or what was going on? And of course, you know, we don't take drugs as Buddhists, so monks. Yeah, except those which are given by the doctor. But You know, that's one of the advantages of not taking alcohol or drugs. You know that what you see is real. It's not imaginary. And so, but it was still quite challenging to me. How come I could see so much more and it looked so much more beautiful once I stopped? It was a very simple explanation because, you know, brought up in a scientific education, you realise it's just when light goes into your eye and hits the back of your eye, the retina, it starts a chemical reaction. But like all chemical reaction, it takes time. Not that long for the colours to form and for the texture and the differences to appear. And unfortunately, we don't have these experiences these days. But in the days when you didn't have digital cameras, when you had photographic film, that usually at school you'd develop, you know, the photograph in this sort of liquid, the developing fluid, whatever it's called. And I remember doing that quite a few times at school. And just you put the paper sort of, you know, in the liquid, and then just slowly just the image of what you'd photograph would slowly appear and get clearer, and the colours would get richer when you left it in this chemicals for longer and longer until the reaction finished. Then you could take the wet photograph, the print out, and let it dry. If you took it out too soon, it wouldn't properly finish and the colours wouldn't be there and the detail would be like washed out. And that's exactly what happens in the retina. So when I was looking through the window of a car, which was going 40, 50, 60 kilometres an hour, my eye would receive the light, but didn't have time to form a proper image in my retina. And so all I ever saw through the window of a car was pastel colours, washed out, didn't have time to fully form. And the detail just was all basically smoothed over. You couldn't actually see the different things which were out there. But when I got out and walked, you know, your eye had more time to form a proper image. But nothing beat just being perfectly still and just staring. And it's just like the photograph started to emerge. Just saw all of the different rocks and the blades of grass rather than just a sheet of green. And all the colours became so incredibly clear because they had a chance to form. And that really emphasised to me the importance of stillness, the restlessness. When you're looking at this, you're looking at that, you're looking at something else, you don't have time to see what's there to begin with. Okay, this is another simile. And I'll make it a bit closer. When I, sometimes as a monk doing the same old thing time and time and time again, it can be a little bit boring. So whenever you get some interesting invitations, then I usually jump at them. And one of the invitations I got a couple of years ago, I mentioned this again many times, was an invitation to give the keynote address at the 2018, or it could be 2019, World Computer Congress in South Korea. Now, many of you know that I don't know hardly anything about computers. You turn them off, press this and press that, and hope it works. And there you were, just giving the keynote address. There's, you know, there's the plenary session. They have the first meeting of all these big shots, you know, members of the government and stuff, and come along and just give the president of the World Computer Congress or something, and then they give their address. And then now the keynote address, which is to set the tone of the conference. And that was me. And so many people asked me, what are you doing here? It went down, and I'm not just saying this, it went down really well. Not only did they give me business class tickets to go to South Korea, Buddhist society, Western Australia paid nothing. So business class tickets, a really nice hotel, and they gave a $2,000 donation afterwards. Mm-hmm. That's really, pretty good, as they used to say in London, a good little earner for Buddhist society. But then, you know, you can't just go there and just stay in your hotel room and come back again. You had to perform to make your visit worthwhile. So then I told him. I picked up, it was one of those plastic water bottles. I picked it up in front of everybody and said, "What is this?" So this is like a glass bottle. "What is this?" "A bottle, yeah. What else is it?" "Come on, give me some information." "What else is it? What else? What else? What else? What else?" And I did this for about 3 or 4 minutes. First of all, people didn't know what I was up to. But being the keynote speaker, they behaved. And then once they got all the names out of their system, I said, "Those are the things you've been taught at school, at university, you've read in books, you've heard from your parents. Keep on looking. Now what do you see? Now you're seeing things you haven't been taught before. New things. Insight. Seeing it in a totally revolutionary way." And I said, in the computer industry, that's one of the things which is so important. Innovation. You can't innovate on old ideas and old concepts. Look at something, look at a problem, stay with it long enough to exhaust all the old descriptions and ideas. Then you might see it anew. I thought, wow, yeah. That was worthwhile inviting this fellow for. But you can see how it works. And that is actually why restlessness, we don't stay long enough with something to really see it. You say, bottle. It's not a bottle. It's that and much, much, much more. And it's seeing that much, much more, that's where we get the deep understandings of life from. And you've heard me say this before. Oh my goodness, I keep going on and on. This clock must be too fast. And this is like a wonderful, just worldly teaching, but it's so helpful. That every time when, you know, I don't really go into prisons much these days because doing too many other things. The time I went in there was just wonderful experiences. Because, you know, all these people are supposed to be prisoners and did terrible, terrible crimes. So I couldn't see those crimes. All I could see was people. And I made the insight there that when you saw a person, you never saw the crime, you saw the person. They're much, much bigger than the crime. And when you saw the person, not the crime, you could actually connect to them. Everyone else in the prison service, they saw the crime. And that's a murderer, that's a rapist, that's a terrorist or something. I just saw this person who'd done a terrible thing. So you're not the terrible thing, that's part of you, but you're much more than that. The same way when you go to a hospital to see maybe your mother or a sister or husband or someone who's really sick. For goodness sake, don't see the sickness. See the person. The doctors, the nurses, they will treat the sickness. You treat the person. They're much more than their sickness. The same with, you know, someone who's in a wheelchair. You're not just disabled or something. There's so much more to you than that. You know that. And when people actually talk to you rather than just the disability, then you're welcome that so much. Because, you know, it's real. So anyway, that's just seeing much deeper than what you've been taught. And that's why that I did an experiment here years ago. And I never told what I was up to at the time. That it happened that we had difficulty finding a cook for the retreat. It was a 9-day retreat. So, you know, because I was basically the boss here then, that they asked, you know, what should we do, Ajahn Brahm? We've got no cook. I said, oh, leave it with me. And we called up the local prison, Karna Prison Farm. So, because it was one of the people that would always come to our classes in Karna, a really good Buddhist. And he said, can you come, be our cook? He could have work release. So he'd come in the morning, the prison van would let him off here. And after lunch, he'd clean up, and then he'd go back to Karna up the road for the rest of the afternoon and evening. He was our cook. And he was an amazing cook. I must admit, it wasn't just because of our meditation was good. Just... he did it all by himself. He said, I don't need much help, and he was just so efficient. And one thing I remember, he would make these pizzas, and he'd make everything himself. Now, even the dough, fresh dough with, you know, flour, whatever else you put in it, and make it in the morning, and just whatever you put on top of it. And it was absolutely amazing, really fresh. Not in a packet, but just did it himself and did all this amazing food all by himself. And it was only after he left, I told the people he was from Karna, and he was in there for violent rape. Ajahn Brahm, what have you done? If I'd have said that to begin with, half of the people would have left. Because I could trust him. I know exactly who he was and why he did those things. You know, it was drug-induced. But he was in jail for a while. But just to see, you know, is that a rapist? Or was that a prisoner? Or was that this wonderful human being who had the opportunity to do some good karma, help me, and help all the people on the retreat at the time? At the end of that, people said, oh yeah, well done. This, the whole idea of what people are was changed. So after a while, you've got to be very careful with those judgments which stop you getting the real truth and insight. He wasn't just a prisoner. He was much more than that. It's not just a bottle. It's much more than that. So anyway, the 500s... In the list, the first one is like wanting something. And that's probably the best simile for that, or just the one-liner. When you want something more, you cannot enjoy what you already have. And I love that saying. Because even when I'm meditating, okay, you're in like Nimitta land or something. I want the jhanas. It all falls apart. When you want something more, you can't enjoy, and the enjoyment of what's happening right now allows you to stay effortlessly in the present moment. Whenever you want something more, whenever, that's very disturbing. And of course, even when you've got bad states of mind, you're really tired or you're restless or something, even if you've got bad states of mind, I also practice and I don't want anything more. It's happening right now, it's right in front of me. I don't know why it's in front of me, but it's obviously I've got to learn something from this. So I never deny what's in front of my mind right now and try and get rid of it and get somewhere else. You allow it to be. And sometimes when you're in physical pain, because of course I'm a human being, I've got a human body, sometimes I have physical pain. And when I've had physical pain, I've learned that if I try and get rid of it, it gets worse. The old monster in the emperor's palace. When you stay with it and be with it, it vanishes. You're kind to it and the monster gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And I don't know that sometimes, you know, getting old, sometimes when you get up in the morning or something, or you get back from some work and you go and sit in your room and you try to meditate, bleh. Your body feels bleh. The mind feels bleh. Or you go bleh. You know what I'm talking about. I feel like that too. But then you just stay with that. You don't try and get rid of it. You don't judge it. You don't stigmatize it. Your mind is much bigger than that. It's just part of it, which is presenting itself to you. Just stay with it. Be kind to it. And honestly, I find that If I don't try and get rid of it, if I don't attach to it if it's pleasant, just leave it alone, let it be, it always gets really peaceful. It may take a few minutes, but then it always disappears. So I remember sometimes in the early morning getting up to meditate, feel tired. Well, you can feel tired. And after a while, the body straightens up, you get energy. Because you're not fighting anything. You're not wasting energy. When I want something, it just really destroys me. It destroys my peace. What do you want? The one thing which you aspire to is peace, contentment. People work so hard so they can say, I'll just clean everything up, do all the dishes, I'll tidy everything up, and then I can have some rest and enjoy myself. You know how to clean things up, you don't know how to rest and enjoy this moment. It doesn't have to be perfect. Please, okay, Leha's a real manager here, so she's not here, I can tell this story. There was this famous monk in Thailand, Ajahn Buddhadasa, and he was building his main meditation hall in his monastery, Suan Mok. And it got to the rains retreat, the 3 months, the rains retreat, where we're supposed to put aside most of the work and just do studies, training, meditation, live life nice and simple for those 3 months. So he sent all the builders home. Come back another 3 months when the rains retreat is over. So they all went away. And the next day or two, a visitor came and he said, when is your hall going to be finished? And without any hesitation, this monk said, sir, it is finished. What do you mean it's finished? Said the visitor. There's no glass in the windows. There's no tiles on the roof. There's bags of cement and pieces of wood all over the place. And is this some sort of artistic statement or something? So no, it's finished. How can you say it's finished? Said the visitor, and the monk replied famously, sir, what's done is finished. And he went off to meditate. I always remember that. Because if I want to find some meditation time, there's always things I haven't completed yet, things I haven't done, things which I should do, emails I should answer, questions I should answer, monks I should tell off, monks I should praise, nuns I should make sure I get their right name next time when I give them some chocolate. All this stuff I should be doing. Nah. If I worry about that, I'll be restless forever. So what's done is finished. It's beautiful. But it did happen once. I get in trouble. But it's funny. Because I told that story on a Friday night talk once. And on a Sunday, these two Sri Lankan parents came to complain. What's wrong? It's a good story. He said, yes, but Ajahn Brahm. Our 17-year-old son, he said he was going out on a Saturday night with his friends, and I made him promise that he won't go out until he's finished his homework. So, you know what's happening. So we asked him as he was going out the door, said, have you finished your homework, son? He said, just like Ajahn Brahm said, what's done is finished. See you tomorrow, Mum. That's a good little ending to that story. But it's true, if you want to have some peace and quiet, some happiness, you never get everything finished. So what's done is finished, and you don't have to be restless. You let things go. So anyway, the wanting is also that one of the nice things about going to airports, sometimes you meet people you would never meet in any other walk of life. You're waiting for an aircraft, you're sitting down, people chat to you. And there's this Middle Eastern guy. I don't know what religion he was or, exactly what he was doing, but we had a little chat for a few minutes. And he told me the two worst curses in the Middle East. If you really want to tell somebody off and give them a hard time. And the second worst curse, number two on the hit list of curses, was I think really imaginative. And it was, May the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your armpits. It's not a nice thing to say to somebody. We can imagine the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your armpits. And the only reason I say that, a bit of fun, but the next one, wow, that was way above the fleas of 1,000 camels curse. And when I heard this one, I thought, wow, whoever invented that had a huge amount of wisdom. And that curse is, may you get everything you want as soon as you want it. Wow. That was so deep. You want a deep talk. May you get everything you want as soon as you want it. If that was happened to you, even for a day, it'd probably drive you crazy. Because a lot of the joy and pleasure of wanting is when you want something and the journey and the striving to get where you want. It's that struggle to actually to meet your wants is where a lot of the pleasure lies. You get it immediately. What's the point? There's a lot of truth to that. So then you understand what this wanting really is. And after a while you think, what do I want that for? And when you actually see the truth of wanting, it just disturbs you and there's no end to it. Well, even if you're really needy. Again, when I was a young monk in Thailand, we didn't have so little stuff. I mean, we were really sort of living on the edge of falling off the edge. So I'd help somebody, you know. People would come and ask some questions, give them a bit of extra advice, and whatever I said had really hit the spot for this Thai gentleman. And so he said, I want to show my gratitude. Anything I can get you, anything you need. And what they do in Thailand, they have this allowance. They call it mendicant allowance. So what you do, you don't just say, you know, what do you need? Oh, yeah, a business class plane ticket to go visit my family in London. You can't say that. These are just poor villagers. So what you actually, they tell you, for about sort of for 100 baht. They actually mention just how much. They can't give you the money, but they can actually give you things for that value. So they came up to me and said, is there anything I can get you for about 100 baht, Thai baht? Not that much these days, but for a poor monk, that was a huge amount. And my mind went blank. I said, oh, I don't know. Because when you know, you didn't want anything to begin with and try to figure out something you want. And he was busy, like many lay supporters were. And I at least had the insight to say, look, can you come back tomorrow? This evening I'll think about it, what I want for 100 baht, and I'll let you know tomorrow. He said, oh, very good idea. Great, I'll see you tomorrow. So that evening, in my heart, after the evening meeting, I got out a piece of paper. I didn't have a piece of paper. It was just the back of a mosquito coil wrapper, which was, you know, clear. And for a pen, I didn't have a pen, I just had a pencil. And just a candle for the light. So I said, what do I want? And so straight away, like a little exercise book. You know, just simple things. You know, so I don't need to write on scraps of paper. Instead of a pencil, maybe like just a cheap biro pen. Now, these are simple things. I wrote the cheap biro pen in pencil on this bit of scrap piece of paper. And then I thought, look, the candles is not good for your eyes. So what they did have, these little oil lamps, the kerosene lamps. And some other monks had those. And so a little kerosene lamp. And I said, when I'm talking about light, my flashlight is just really dull. You know, and flashlights and new batteries, because this is really important. In those paths in time, there's snakes and centipedes and the mottling, the biting ants. And so I wrote down flashlight. Then I added up and it's more than 100 baht. Which one can I take off? And that's what I was thinking, what to take off. I thought, well, when you got paper, I should actually get some aerograms so I can write some letters to my mother. And I need this and I need that and I need this and I need that. And in a couple of more minutes, 1,000 baht would not have been enough. But at least I realised what was going on. And I took that piece of paper, I screwed it up, and I threw it in the waste bin. And the next day, when this guy came, I told him, don't ever do that to me again. Okay, I was writing on the back of scrap piece of paper and pencil by candlelight, but I wasn't doing that much. It was fine. I was surviving. But I could not survive when I had the means to get so much stuff that I could not tolerate. It showed me just about the pain of wanting. You don't have anything. You're happy. So what do you want? So if, for some wonderful good karma, you lose all your money, yeah, then you don't want anything. Do you agree with me? Do you understand? No, you don't. But it's the same with your meditation. What do you want in your meditation? He said, I want to be enlightened. Do you? You know, if you're enlightened, you know, there's no more peace, excuse me the words, no more sexuality. You just can't. Full enlightenment. You're not interested in watching the TV anymore. So you can't see the next episode or whatever else is streaming right now. You're not interested in sports. You're not interested in anything. Sometimes, if you really understand what enlightenment is, people say, well, maybe not. Maybe I'll get enlightened tomorrow or next week or next year or something. A lot of times, this was a story when I was, I'll give a talk on Five Hindrances tomorrow. when I was a school kid, because of good scholarships, I went to this really good school in West London, and they had a chaplain, you know, an Anglican. And I thought, well, you got a chaplain there, it doesn't do very much. So I went to see him, because I said, I was actually interested. I wasn't challenging. Now, what is this God business? What is God? You know, you're supposed to be the expert in this school. So tell me what God is, because I'm interested but confused. And then he told me that God is the beginning and end of all things, ineffable. You can't explain it. It's got no name. It's the ground of all being, the Alpha and Omega. I said, that doesn't make any sense to me. What is it? Oh, it's beginning of, it's unexplainable. And I came across, what came across was he didn't know what he was talking about. If you know what you're talking about, you can explain it. And so I went away just quite disillusioned. Then later on, when I became a Buddhist in the university, I went to ask these great teachers and monks, what is enlightenment? And they said, it's unexplainable, beginning and end of all things, ineffable, the ground of all being. I've heard that before somewhere. So do you know what you're talking about? So on that, I should continue the story. What is enlightenment anyway? Finally, you got a decent answer to that. And why, we let go of craving and wanting. And what happens is enlightenment. Yeah, explain more, Ajahn Brahman. Here it is. It's a beautiful explanation. Again, many of you have heard it before. Until I get a better explanation, you'll hear it next time as well. But it was the five children playing the wishing game. And the rules of the wishing game go like this. You have a wish, and the kid who comes up with the best wish wins the wishing game. Simple. So the first kid, this boy, said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for a new PlayStation. Do you like playing games, computer games? Fair enough. The second one has more time. So if ever you're in some sort of panel discussion or something, always be the last one. Just like this other story of these three religious leaders, the monk, the rabbi, and the Christian priest. And they were meeting together to discuss, you know, their religions, the truths, but also to get together and have a bit more harmony and bonding together. And they would meet and have cups of tea, but that wasn't sort of enough to really challenge themselves and challenge their boundaries and just actually get closer together and understand each other. So they started playing games. They started playing poker. And to make it more interesting, they started playing for money. It's a way of, like, you know, spending time together and coming together. But unfortunately, that was illegal in that country, so they got arrested. And they had to go to trial. And at the trial, it was the Christian priest had to answer the judge first of all, look, you're all three religious leaders, so I'm not going to waste time. Were you gambling? Which is illegal, you know that. Were you gambling, Reverend? And really quickly, quicker than the judge could see, he looked up in the sky, please forgive me, Lord, and said no. Okay, you can go. And then asked the rabbi. Rabbi, were you gambling? The rabbi put his hands behind his back and crossed his fingers. Did you ever do that at school? Cross your fingers and said, no, I wasn't gambling. I don't know how that absolves you of guilt. But anyway, they used to do that. And so, okay, you can go. And asked the Buddhist monk. And the judge was getting a bit suspicious of the other two, so, you know, you don't believe in God, so you can't just ask for forgiveness and keep your hands in front of you. Were you gambling? And the monk replied, with whom, Your Honour? So always be the last one. But anyway... go back to, oh yeah, where were we? Oh yeah, the second kid. If you had a wish, what would your wish be? And the second kid said, well, if I had a wish, I would wish for a computer game shop. If I owned the shop, I wouldn't just get one PlayStation, I'd get the next one when it comes out and the one after that. I own the whole shop, so I can get much more, much better wish. Yeah, it's true. So ask the third kid. If you had a wish, what would it be? Third kid. Was really, really smart. She said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for $10 billion US. That's a wish. With $10 billion US, I can buy my own computer shop. But the problem is, when I play games, my mummy and daddy keep telling me to do my homework, first of all. And that just really sort of takes away the pleasure of playing games. So, after I bought my own computer game shop, then I'll buy my own school. If I own a school, if any of the teachers gives me homework, or I get sent to the principal's office, I say, look, I'm paying you. This is my school. And that way I won't need to do any work. When I graduate from my own primary school, I'll buy a high school. When I graduate from high school, I buy my own university. So I can play computer games all day. And when anything else I want, for $10 billion US, oh, crikey, you can spend that. Except governments. So that was a $10 billion US wish. Beat that. There's two more people yet to come on this game. And a fourth kid, again, really smart too. And he really thought he cracked it. No one can beat this wish. He said, if I had a wish, I wish for three wishes. That's a wish. For my first wish, I'll have the computer game shop. With my second wish, I'll have $10 billion US. For my third wish, I'll have three more wishes. No. That way I can go on forever. Beat that. And the fourth kid was so peaceful and so calm and just had his inner wisdom and very easily beat the infinity of wishes. Wish. The last kid said, if I had a wish, I wish I was so content and happy, I never needed a wish ever again. And that describes enlightenment. So happy, so at peace, you never need any more wishes ever again. That's beautiful. The reason I love that story, because it takes you from the very beginning of just what you want. You want your dinner, you want something for dinner, you want sort of small things like a computer game, or second one, just a bit more opportunity to get more money, more things. The third one, infinity of wealth. Thinking that if you're wealthy, you can be really happy. You ever notice all these incredible wealthy people, they're never satisfied, so they want to become presidents of big countries. Who would ever? Would you really want that if you got just billions of dollars? What would you want to be president for? And get lots of suffering? Can't you retire and just do nothing? No, because it's not enough. You have wealth, but you don't have power. That's a fourth wish. The infinity of wishes granted. That's where you need to be dictators or heads of government to try and get more wishes given to you. Money doesn't get it. But the best wish of all, be so content, you never needed any wishes ever again. That's enlightenment, that's the Buddha. And that's an incredibly wonderful explanation. It's not just disbelief, or it's unexplainable, or it's ground of all being. It's something which tells you what it must be like and how to get there. No wishes. You're sitting here, really tired. Let yourself be tired. Be kind enough to your body and mind. It's been working really hard so far in your life, so give it a break. I don't need any more wishes when I'm meditating. I'm not trying to get somewhere when I don't know what it's going to be like when I get there. It's like going on those magical mystery tours. Get jhanas. Ajahn says they're really wonderful. And you believe me. Are they wonderful? Actually, they are. But sometimes you think, no, I won't want a jhana. I'll just be peaceful. I'll see if I can just be this wonderful state where I don't need any wishes, just content. Sitting comfortably on a seat or walking meditation, just being here. Not wanting anything in the whole world. Now that is blissful. And that is a path into the jhanas and enlightenment, the whole works. So, I'll continue on with the five Indrian system tomorrow, maybe. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay. Oh boy.